Cambridge 105.
Community radio in your city.
And my guest this afternoon is the one and only Nick Barraclough. Good afternoon to you, Nick.
Hello, Paul.
It's when did you do your first radio, Nick? Because you've done loads.
First radio was May the 1st, 1982.
Right.
When Radio Cambridge had went on the air.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll ask you a bit later how you managed to get in there.
Yeah.
You know. I don't know whether you walked in and you said, oh, here I am, or whether you had to knock their door.
It's a very good question. It's quite a good story.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. You've said off air, which I'd guessed, is that you are a Cambridge born and bred and family links that go back.
Yeah, we're looking earlier this year, I think, around the Mill Road Cemetery at ancestors of ours. And older listeners may remember Webb's, W.F. Webb, on Mill Road, on the Broadway.
Yeah.
He had a toy shop on one side of the road, an electrical shop on the other side. Now a posh fish and chip shop, and I think a charity shop. And my mother and her seven brothers and sisters and parents lived in the two-bedroom flat above the shop.
Did they? So,
and then my dad, who was from Womwell near Barnsley in Yorkshire, was based near Cambridge in the war, in Bomber Command, and they met at the Dorothy Ballroom.
Oh.
You know, perfect Cambridge sort of, you know, background, really.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And were they musical people? Because you're a very musical chap.
My father's mother taught piano. She was the only musician in the family on either side, though my mother sang, and still does, sang to us all the time as children. And my parents had a record player and a lot of records. And we listened to everything from Gilbert and Sullivan, which I hated and would tell them all the time how much I hated, though actually some of the tunes got to be quite good, through Chopin, Beethoven and Cliff Richard and, of course, the Beatles when they came along, and folk music. So I heard some folk music when in the 50s when a lot of people didn't, you know. So there was a lot of music around, yeah.
Right, OK. So when you got to school, this is something that I do speak to a fair number of people from, you know, the modern era, and I say to them, you know, when you were at school, everybody had an instrument. I said, when I was at school, 60s, 70s, it was just, you know, one or two people. The school band probably comprised of everybody that played.
It's interesting because when nowadays a child wakes up on a Saturday morning and says, quite fancy playing the guitar, and they've got one by lunchtime. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They go into town, they buy one, you go online and get one sent to you in 2 days. I asked for a guitar, I think, first when I was 9, and I got one when I was 11. And I'll never forget the door opening to our living room where I was sitting watching television with my brother, and my father's hand coming through the door holding a neck of it was a Valencia cello guitar, plywood guitar. From that moment that I saw that at the age of 11, my life changed.
Right.
Absolutely changed. Because having a guitar was just such a rare thing. And I'd never touched one. I'd only seen one once. And that was when we went camping in France. And I saw a bloke busking and just watched it and looked at it. But now, of course, everything's just there on a plate.
Yeah.
You know, I had to work for it.
So, age 11, with guitar, what did you do? Get somebody to teach you, or did you teach yourself?
I had a friend called Brian Carling, whose brother Ivan, you'll know, a stalwart of the Cambridge music scene. We didn't know it then. I mean, Ivan would have been 15, so he was much older than us. And I strung the guitar into a chord, an open chord, because I didn't know how to tune it. So I tuned it to an open chord and thrashed away at it and thought, oh, this is easy, just move one finger up and down it. Then I went to see Brian, said, no, come and talk to Ivan because he can play properly. And Ivan said, no, you tune it like this. And I, oh, you've got to put your fingers in different places. I don't know if I want to do this after all. But then, of course, stuck at it. So Ivan taught me my first chords, and Brian and Rod Halls, who went on to become the headmaster of Linton School and well-known teacher around these parts. Rod and I played together. And each when one learned something new, he went and told the other one, I've learned this chord, look at this, try this. And then the folk club, when I was 15, started going to the folk club in the Red Cow, now just the Cow.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And on a Saturday night.
Near the Corn Exchange.
Near the Corn Exchange.
There it is, yeah.
It was there. Then it was in the Lion Hotel, now the Lion Yard. Then the Portland Arms, of course.
Yeah.
And that folk club was a fantastic breeding ground, and amazing musicians, amazing quality of players, and the guests who came along. And the interval, you went up to whoever been playing the first half and said, how did you do that? What was that called? What was that song? Where did you find that? And it was through learning by ear and having to learn fast, because once you've heard a song, you wouldn't hear it again. You had to learn it just there and then. Doesn't that sharpen you up, as opposed to going onto YouTube and seeing it and playing it back in slow?
Yeah, the facilities that they've got now.
Yeah.
We were struggling. I can remember that as a child. You put the radio on, and if you managed, I mean, once the Pirates got there, it was a bit easier. But once you heard a new release, like a Beach Boys song or something, you just couldn't wait to hear it again.
When would I hear it again? You'd listen all day long just to hear that one song. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Those were the days. But that was where you learnt to play. And then I would imagine sometime in your youth then, because I was young, you were a bit older than me, Nick, somebody decided that Cambridge ought to have its very own folk festival. You must have been delighted.
Yeah, Ken Woolard was on the committee of the Cambridge Folk Club. It was he who said, Ralph McTell, £25. You're joking.
Right.
That's ridiculous money to pay anybody. But Ken was on the committee. He was quite a political bloke. A big Labour Party supporter, fireman at the time.
Yeah.
And then it was mooted that, so he talked to someone in the council, that a folk festival should be started. And I went to the second one. I didn't go to the first. My sisters went to that because they were older than me. And the second one, I remember there was a sort of 3-foot-high picket fence around the festival area inside Cherrington Hall, which by 9 o'clock they even just got trampled down and everybody wandered in.
Yeah.
It was fabulous. I couldn't believe that, because this was like the folk club only, you know, times 100. And American players came. Tom Rush came. People like that. And it was unbelievable. And Ken's great gift in running the folk festival was that he wasn't much of a folk fan, really. He was, actually, if anything, he was a jazz fan. He was a big Duke Ellington fan. But because he had that objectivity, I think people who are obsessed by one sort of music shouldn't necessarily make programmes about it, you know, me making country music programmes, or festivals about it, because then they have an objectivity and they don't give way to their personal passions. They look at what people want and provide it. And Ken was brilliant at that.
Right, yeah. I read, I researched it all up, actually. I did something myself, which is actually on a CD, did go out on a couple of the other community stations, that said that he was influenced by a big jazz festival in Newport, Rhode Island.
Yes, the Newport Jazz Festival, yeah.
And I can't remember the rest of the story, but it's all out. It's there somewhere.
Yeah.
There was a couple of books. One of them was 10 Years of Folk and the other was 30. And
It's amazing, because he was able to keep it going. There were times when the council talked about sacking him, getting a professional, in inverted commas, director in to do it. And which would have been nuts. Eddie Barkin had a very, very difficult shoes to fill when he took over after Ken died. But he did so, and has done so, brilliantly. But no, Ken just, without that foundation that he gave the festival, it wouldn't be going today. It would have just, he never allowed it to get too big. He always kept it a little bit special. And of course, always kept the local side involved, kept the local folk clubs involved, local musicians playing. That was always a very important part of it. So I think, unlike a lot of festivals around the country, the place where the Cambridge Folk Festival lives is invested in it, and that's really important.
Great. Okay, you've brought in some of your choices.
Yeah.
And one of them's an early band of your own, which I don't remember the name of at all.
This is a band I was in about 1970. I got on the 106 bus to come back from a job I had in town working for Joshua Taylor's, and a girl got on the bus with long blonde hair and a Martin guitar. So I thought, right.
So a mugger. Yeah.
Taking her home for lunch. she was American. She was over at the art school. She had a record deal, and we were married a couple of years later. We're now just good friends. But we put a band together with Steve Brooks, who was a window dresser at Eden Lilly's. No, Robert Sales, I think he was. Steve Brooks, and a brilliant songwriter. And he and Anne wrote songs. And the band was called Baby Whale, and we got a big record deal in 1971. Made this record in Rockfield in Wales, which never got released, but we've just sort of secretly put it out. And this, from the Baby Whale album, is Anne singing her song, which is called The Old Man and the Sea.
Right, we'll play it now.
Afternoons with Paul Christofori.
And before that, Paul Simon from his album Hearts and Bones and the track Train in the Distance, which had a different ending to the one I remembered. Maybe I've been listening to singles that fade, but that ended because it was from an album. Do you remember that?
He likes his long, long endings. Gradually, the same riff going over and over again, but the instruments that are forward change. So you're left with just a cello going da 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 da. Fantastic track, that.
Wonderful, wonderful contribution he's made to our lives, Paul Simon.
He really,
one of my absolute favourites, I'm sure, is yours.
It's just the artist, you hear so much. I'm sorry, I'm going to sound like the age I am, but you hear so much disposable music written these days that's of no consequence at all. And you look at a song like that, and the way. It's funny, my son, who writes songs, said to me, "Why don't you write songs?" Because I don't. And I'm trying to convey to him the point that actually, you get a huge amount of joy from learning somebody else's songs like that. You learn a song like Train in the Distance by Paul Simon, and you get into the anatomy of it. And by learning it, you think you really fully appreciate how brilliant a songwriter like he is. It's unbelievable.
Right. I didn't know you'd never written any yourself.
I've written half a dozen songs. And they're all right.
Okay. going back to the sort of era of that first band called Baby Whale, when you were kind of on a retainer. I mean, when you say you were on a retainer, I listened to a documentary about the Zombies and Odyssey and Oracle, which went out on BBC Six a couple of nights ago.
Oh, yeah.
Saying how they couldn't maintain the band because they hadn't sold hardly any copies of their album and they split. And you're saying that an album that never even came out had... Yeah. You were still carrying on because you were on a retainer.
Yeah.
So you reversed the roles.
They paid us. They paid for that to be made. The record company advanced us a huge amount of money.
What was the record?
The record company was DJM.
Oh yes, yeah.
Dick James Music, who at the time had
Elton
John. That's right, and the Beatles at one point. He had their.
He owned their publishing. Yeah.
He did at one point. It's just insane when you think about it. And I always remember going to his office when we signed the contract. He said, "Remember, boys, remember, you can't beat a good tune." And we went away thinking, "Yeah, that's the old man." But it was Dick James who had the hit with Robin Hood in the 50s, right. Riding Through the Glen.
Oh, right.
Yeah. But so the money was.
Glad you haven't bought it, Nick.
We didn't know our backsides from our elbows at the time. We really, really, but we thought we did. We thought we knew everything.
Right. Was that kind of... We kind of... Last week, the chap... forgotten his name. I need to remember it. Mark Brinkley, the man who I say invented... Well, he certainly helped Strawberry Fair, said that, you know, when he'd finished studying, he'd not carried on with what he studied and he sort of fell away a bit and dropped out. And I think there was a lot of that going on and we kind of decided that you can't do that now. You know,
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah,
because you've got some teenage children. Are they still teenagers?
Only just. Right. I've got hang on, 19-year-old son. Got to get that right. Is he 19? Yeah. And a 22-year-old daughter.
Right.
She wants to be an actor and he wants to be a musician. What can possibly go wrong, as they say? But in our time, you could go and work in a shop for a bit and then wander off and do something else.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can't do that now. I mean, I do say to my kids, don't worry about making a living until you're in your 30s. Enjoy your 20s.
Right.
Go and do all these things that nobody else dares do while you can. You know, as long as you can pay for get a roof over your head and to eat, you've got to do that. But I don't think you have to launch yourself into a career straight away. Go and wait until you've got these things out of your system, then do that.
Yep. Well, it's a nice way of going about it. And it's worked for you, Nick. It's worked for you. That's definite. You got through the 70s with that band, and then Telephone Bill and the Smooth Operators.
Yeah.
Which they did you know, they certainly were we did lots of work.
We toured all over the country and halfway around the world playing to the troops in places like the Indian Ocean and Central America and Cyprus. And we played folk clubs to start off with and concerts. The mistake we made was to, going back to what we were talking about, what kids should do these days, the mistake we made was to start worrying about making a living. And our agent said, I can get you 2 months touring, 50 dates, opening for Max Boyce. And you're playing the biggest venues in the country. You're playing to a minimum of 2,000 people a night. It's a lot of people, but they weren't our audience. So we went and did that because we made enough money to pay the, you know, to maybe get a mortgage and all this sort of thing, which is great. But as far as the scene was concerned, we disappeared, paradoxically. Then we did the same thing with Jasper Carrot. Again, great audiences, and we had a great time, went down very well, and we'd flog records in the interval out the front, you know, in the foyer. Mm. And we made some money, but it didn't further the band's career at all, and things moved on. And of course, baby, Telephone Bill, a five-piece, doo-wop, country, bluesy, old poppy acoustic band was trying to do well when the only thing anybody was writing about was punk.
Oh.
So we were stuffed.
Yes.
Completely.
Yes.
We couldn't have been less... 10 years ago, we'd have been in our element because of bands like, there was I always think of Matthews and Son. There's a shop on
Manhattan
Trinity
Transfer.
Street.
Well, they were a similar sounding band from my memory.
Yes, and
they did make a mark in that era because there was still.
They were American. There was a huge amount of money behind them, and they were very glitzy.
Yeah,
and we were tried. We were sold like a Manhattan Transfer sort of thing by one guy who put some money into us, who was a guy called Mike Smith, whose next venture was a television series called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? So right. He did okay in the end.
So he is.
Yes, so he is, and we're not. So it was a great band. It was a lovely band, Telephone Bill. It was great fun, and we were innovative, but we just really, really weren't what was selling and what people were looking for.
Right.
Not in the mid-late 70s.
Something that gets pointed out about the punk era is that the Beatles had done it, done something similar, in that they wiped everything else out and took all the attention and nobody wanted to know too much else. But if you go back to 77, apart from the punks, people were all dancing to Night Fever and the Bee Gees, which was a million miles away.
Yes, that was even further, actually, from us and punk was.
Even further away.
The only stuff that was successful, that we liked, though we weren't anything like it, was the American LA sound and the Eagles and Steely Dan and the Doobie Brothers and Little Feet. And that stuff we liked, but we weren't... And we tried to move towards that later in our career, but we couldn't do it.
Right.
We just wasn't in us.
Afternoons with Paul Christofori. Cambridge 105.